For those of you who are visiting and may be wondering, because I saw some eyes directed to it, what the dangling wire is up in the ceiling, this is not a permanent part of our architectural design. This will accommodate one more fire detector, which the security people wish to install, but they are waiting to do it until our 6-foot brass chandeliers arrive, 2 of them going in this sanctuary with 3 matching wall sconces on each side. I talked to a very jovial gentleman in New York City the other day who assured me as he has assured a number of other people from one coast to the other that our lights have cleared custom and should be here by the end of this week. We'll see. I'm talking about the risks and rewards of preaching simply because the best way I know to honor the memory of Joe is to say something about an activity he honored and supported so much. So much that, as I told you, without him, it's quite possible that I might not only not be here, but might not be preaching at all. And that would have been painful to me because I like what I do. I've often said to my classes at the university how extraordinary it is to be paid for doing something which is so much fun most of the time that I would pay for the privilege. It was my hope that they would not mention this to the Board of Regents. But apparently some of them did. So I realize how risky it is to tell you that I like to preach so much I would be tempted to pay somebody to let me do it if that were my last option. I really do identify with a little boy who used to live next door to me who was fascinated by power mowers and was just learning to mow lawns. He could hardly wait for the grass to come up. One spring, it was to be his first time to cut it all by himself. He made his own lawn look wonderful, and then he started looking across the fence at mine. The yearning was so intense that I couldn't resist it. I walked to the fence and said, "Would you like to mow my lawn?" "Oh, yes." I said, "How about $5? He dropped his head and started to walk away. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I only have $2. I understood that day what it means to want to do something so much you would pay for the privilege. But I don't want to bog down in false sentiment. I like most things about preaching, but not everything. And one thing I have a little trouble with is the word preacher. I don't like that word much, and I do verbal gymnastics to avoid having to use it or having to hear it used to describe what I do. There are 2 reasons. Both of them having to do with certain connotations that hover around the word preacher. One of them is related to the stereotypes that arise in people's minds when they hear the word. Without malice, without any conscious knowledge that they are doing it, people slip you neatly into a pigeonhole the moment they learn you are a preacher. So in the university and out in the wide world apart from this lovely place, I rather like to be discovered as a man who preaches only after I have been known for a while in other ways as a normal human being. Because with many people, I cannot be known that way if they think preacher first. There isn't anything new about this. In his famous Phi Beta Kappa speech At Harvard, 160 years ago, Ralph Waldo Emerson had this to say about clergymen. And I'm sure you'll forgive him at that date for his touch of male chauvinism. I have heard it said that the clergy, who are always more universally than any other class, the scholars of their day, are addressed as women. That the rough, spontaneous conversation of men, they do not hear, but only a mincing and diluted speech. They are often virtually disfranchised. And indeed, there are advocates for their celibacy. Disfranchised, deprived of a right or a privilege. In this case, the right to be real. The privilege of being in all sorts of ways like other people. Most of my colleagues hate it when people start tidying up their speech and trying to sound suddenly interested in religion when one of them joins the group. I am disfranchised when a man who sprinkles his talk normally with vivid and colorful epithets hides it all for my delicate sake and plays verbally what he thinks clergymen should be allowed to hear. I am disfranchised when somebody supposes that all I ever want to talk about is theology, budgets, and baptisms. Any minister is disfranchised when people expect him to be their surrogate sacrifice to God, their hired devotion, their substitute for personal goodness. He, and often now she, is disfranchised when people expect her never to be tired, never to be short of temper, never to stumble. Whenever the church fails to recognize that the person in the pulpit needs to laugh, needs to play, and needs most urgently of all to be himself, an ordinary human being who carries the everlasting gospel in a vessel that is never quite worthy of it. My other concern about the word preacher is the connotation that word has of one who is tediously and pretentiously didactic, who comes down on you with a heavy and pompous moral certainty about all sorts of things, who does, in short, what we mean when we say, quit preaching to me. Weak people will often tolerate that. Strong people turn away from it. I still remember a character in George Meredith's novel, The Ordeal of Richard Feverel, who says this: the born preacher, and that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with people who stand in pulpits. There are born preachers who have never been in pulpits. The born preacher, we feel instinctively to be our enemy. He may do some good to the wretches that have been struck down and lie gasping on the battlefield, but he rouses deadly antagonism in the strong. I think that's true. Strong people will not tolerate being preached at. They insist that you share quietly and with conviction what you feel and what you have learned, and they reserve the right to embrace it or to let it pass. But you do need to have learned something if you preach. I went by it rather quickly, but did you notice what Emerson said about the ministers of a century and a half ago? He said they are always more universally than any other class, the scholars of their day. That has changed so much it is almost embarrassing to bring it up. I live much of my life in the world of the university, where along with the few inevitable frauds and phonies, there is also a very respectable amount of scholarship. And in that world, preachers are stereotyped as rather nice people who do good works, but whose intellect is highly suspect. I almost think I'd rather be dead than to be known simply as nice. What a pale, tepid description of a life. No wonder someone defined a great deal of preaching as a mild-mannered attempt by a mild-mannered person to get mild-mannered people to be even more mild-mannered. The only way you can get a reputation for being nice is to shape your life and your thought in ways that will avoid criticism. How dreadful. I read this entry one day in the minutes of an old church in New England. We have appointed a committee to examine the squeak in the pulpit. I have met that squeak, and you've heard it, and because you are strong, you have said it must be a voice instead of a squeak. Somebody who will run a risk, dare to be honest about a difficult problem, not mind letting us see from week to week into a heart and mind as restless and curious and even as confused as our own. In other words, I would like the word preacher to stand for one who searches with honesty for the truth that is enduring against the truth that is useful only for a day. Because, to be candid, I am embarrassed by the reputation the word preacher has in the world of educated and deeply curious people. For example, there are millions of mothers in this country who would announce joyously that their daughters were engaged to marry doctors, lawyers, bankers, builders, but would cringe a little in spite of themselves if they had to say she's going to marry a preacher. This was not always the case. There was a time when one man in an English village was known to native and visitor alike as the person, capital T, capital P, the person of that place. This honorific title came from his being the one man who could be certain to have had a formal education, who had traveled some, who could speak with authority about all sorts of things. When the principal landowner was away, the person became the resident squire, as much admired during the week as he was on Sundays when he was filling the pulpit in his capacity as a preacher. The person of the village was a preacher. But the curious history of that title, the person, shows us how the reputation of the preacher has declined. Think about the English pronunciation of the phoneme ER in a word like D-E-R-B-Y. Kentucky Derby, but English Derby. And how C-L-E-R-K was pronounced Clark. And you'll discover the origin of our peculiar word for a preacher. P-E-R-S-O-N was pronounced parson. The person was the parson. And it was a complimentary title until by and by it became a joke. For a while in colonial America, the parson, continued to be the man in town who knew about things, the man with an education, the man who had books and read them. But you can't watch movies and TV today without realizing the disrepute into which the title parson has fallen. Now it has a rather contemptuous sound. It is a favorite word in jokes about ministers, used to identify a bumbling nincompoop, rather nice, but not quite bright enough for the real world, and sometimes not even nice. Sometimes arrogant in his ignorance. The kind of preacher a friend of mine described to me last week by saying, I couldn't warm up to that guy if we were cremated together. There are a lot of reasons for this genteel stupidity or mindless arrogance on the part of those of us who preach. One of them being laziness. But since I'm talking to listeners rather than preachers, I'll speak only of how listeners like you can make preachers better. They must insist that he keep time for study, for solitude, for reflection, no matter how much he may want to do a host of other things that might endear him to his congregation, like laying grass. They must see to it that he does not fall victim to busyness. They must remind him that he was not called to become a professional friend. If you don't know what that means, a Presbyterian tract I saw the other day will explain it. It said, call your minister to share all your moments of joy. Call him when you have a birthday. Call him when a son or daughter is going off to college. Well, maybe. Sometimes. But unless it's a very small church, and he's had a chance to know the son or daughter extremely well, he may have to fake a genuine interest when you make the call. And faking an interest too many times is what turns a preacher into a parody of a real human being. He can shoulder only so much of your life. If he is to be genuine, with a gift of honest friendship, he has to call a halt sometimes to the drain on his emotional resources, and you have to help him do it. I am not, by the way, making a case for the minister at University Congregational Church. You are not the kind of people who create such problems. I agree with my preaching son that few ministers in all the world are as lucky as I am when it comes to an audience. And he and I, and all others who preach, know how vital an audience is to the growth and development of a minister. I think a physician can practice medicine skillfully, even if his patients are not directly feeding his emotional and intellectual life. I think an attorney can apply and interpret the law brilliantly without an intimate relationship with his clients. But a minister is directly nourished and sustained and even created by those who listen to him. If they are good listeners, he will become a good minister or have no choice but to leave. Good listeners insist on hearing something. This may shock you, and if it does, you can discount as much of it as you need. But I read once that when Alexander White began his great ministry in Glasgow, his elders told him bluntly that if he were faced with a choice between answering a summons to visit the dying or preparing his Sunday sermon, and if he could do the one or the other, but not both, he ought to prepare his Sunday sermon. Now, I've never known a minister who could have made the choice they recommended, but I'm sure they knew that when they said this extraordinary thing, and so did he. In practical, real-life situations, he probably never had to choose their option, but he had gotten the message. Take your responsibility to your Sunday audience seriously. Out of that surprising advice came one of the most famous ministries in the English-speaking world, shaped by a man who, I will guarantee you, was always far enough in his studies so that he never had to turn down a summons to visit the dying. Final word about how to help a preacher survive. Put the best possible interpretation on what he says instead of the worst, so that he will not be afraid to share his thought and convictions with you. If you remain in doubt about what he meant, ask him. It's always a compliment to any speaker to be asked what he meant, because that proves that at least one person was listening. That is, if you do it in a spirit of fairness and openness, and not like the person my friend and colleague told me about last week. One of his lay people had called him a communist. He said he couldn't figure out what had provoked that accusation, so he asked another church member why the man would have said such a thing. Why would he have called me a communist? And that person replied, well, what he really wanted to say was that you were a Democrat, but he didn't want to go that far. I'm not finished with this subject, but I'm going to defer the rest of it until 4 years from now, on a cold February morning in 1991, at which time, if I am lucky enough to be present, we are going to celebrate together an extraordinary anniversary. I will not tell you what it is. And I found out as I drove out here that Billy cannot tell you what it is. She couldn't guess. So we'll just wait. Until then, thank you for being out there and for being the most receptive audience I have ever known. If I don't grow up and make a preacher, it won't be your fault.